You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Jedediah Barry is the author of the novel The Manual of Detection and a story in cards of family arcana. His new novel is The Naming Song. Thank you for joining me, Jed.
Thanks so much. Really happy to be here.
This is a really amazingly awesome novel, and I love it because it's about language, about words, and it's about naming, the importance of names. It also has some really amazing scenes and characters in it. One of the things I read your novel, The Manual of Detection, and loved it. Yes. Talk a little bit about telling a story in cards, the family arcana. I have not seen this, and I think it might bear some prototypeness to this novel.
Yeah, sure. So The Family Arcana is a project I undertook in between the writing of my first novel, The Manual of Detection, and the new one, The Naming Song. And it is a story that is published as a deck of cards. There is a little piece of the text on each card. It's a standard poker deck, and you shuffle it up and read it in a random order each time. And it's written so that it always coheres as a story. It's kind of a Gothic American fable. That rose out of an idea of just wanting to play with form and also just kind of break out of some narrative traps that I felt I was falling into as a writer, like trying to write a thing scene by scene, like a movie or something. And so that really was a fun way to play with structure and play with tone and just have a lot of, have a lot of fun with my reader, hopefully, too. It's kind of an interactive process.
The Naming Song is such a fascinating book. Talk about creating a book. I mean, it goes against many novelistic traditions. In the first case, we have a main character who has no name and never really gets one during the narrative. When did you make that decision?
So early on, I decided that I was writing a book in which language had been erased from the world, and the people in the setting are in the process of like reintroducing words. And I thought it would be interesting to have this character who was really deep inside that process. She is a courier who works for the names committee. So it is her job to actually deliver words to things that need names. But I wanted her to be kind of inside and outside at the same time. So she herself is nameless because she had a very odd upbringing. And this is not one of those things where like the narrator simply doesn't refer to the character by name. She does in fact not have a name. And it let me explore the kind of some of the complicated themes of what it means to be named or what it means to be nameless, what it means to try to introduce something into the world which you yourself have a very complicated relationship with.
One of the things that's kind of amazing about this book is that while we have recognizable human characters and human events and human relationships, I don't think I've ever read a novel that is any way resembles any of this. The way this is put together, this is one of the most original works I've seen. Yeah, I found what I thought were a lot of really interesting literary references in the book. I guess the one that's the most obvious is Lewis Carroll.
Right, right.
But I have to ask, as a fan of Harlan Ellison, I'm wondering, were the Harlan Ellison references at something that I made up in the depths of my tiny brain, or are they real?
Oh, wow. It is possible that the Ellison references are there without my even thinking. I remember reading his story, The man who rowed Christopher Columbus ashore when I was in high school, I think. And that was just like a favorite of mine. I read a lot of his fiction, and it seems likely to me that it's influencing me in ways I hadn't considered. But you're right, certainly, about Lewis Carroll. I mean, part of what I was playing with was this idea that if language and stories are kind of wiped away, and in the science fictional premise of this book, like, there's basically a generation that comes to be without language, but there are a few old children's stories which survive the silence, as I call it, because a few of the people who are very young as children are very old once language returns. So they don't know, they can't say, like, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, they don't know the name Lewis Carroll, but they are able to say things like, well, it's about a child who went underground. And so they're able to tell the story in these, like, very rudimentary ways. So that one survives, and the Oz story survives, and a few others.
Well, I'll just say that Harlan Ellison wrote two very famous TV scripts, two for The Outer Limits, one Cold Soldier that was, he ended up suing Cameron and getting money from Cameron for providing the seed of Terminator. But he wrote a story called Demon with a Glass Hand, and there is a man with a glass hand who features prominently in your narrative.
Oh, I need to revisit that.
Also, he wrote the screenplay for what is arguably one of the best scripts of Star Trek, the original series, the series on The City on the Edge of Forever.
Yes.
And you use that phrase, The City on the Edge of, numerous times.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Oh, good eye. Yeah. Maybe I think you've got something there.
Well, it's in what's left of my tiny brain. Now, talk about... one of the things I love about this book is that it clearly has kind of science fictional roots, but it's completely and utterly and remains thus divorced from our reality. There's no, like, real signal signs or omens about how things happened. It just happened. And I think one of the things I love about this book is that it really treads that line between science fiction and science fantasy and fantasy really well. Talk about, you know, your intentions and creating a second, what is essentially a second world fantasy, but based on a science fiction concept that's concealed from the inhabitants of the world you create.
Yes, right. Well, thank you for that question. And yeah, the part of the idea here is that the apocalyptic event that erased language from the world is something that is by its nature unknowable to the characters living there. They have some vague sense of what happened. The closest they can get to describing it is that something fell from the something tree. They don't know exactly what that means. And I think I had
that's your t-shirt.
There it is. Yeah. We could do t-shirts of that. Kind of like a almost reverse Garden of Eden or something. The science fantasy element was important to me because I felt like I needed a kind of freedom in building this world from the ground up. And what I wanted to do, I didn't really know this going in, but it's something I figured out in the process of writing it, is that I wanted to have everyday words and language feel like they had magical capabilities, because when a word is new, it's a big deal in this book. It's kind of an event when such a thing happens. And of course, I mean, a book is made of words, and so I am working with the material that in the world of the story has this magical connotation. And so I was kind of building it almost like a poem. I mean, it's obviously a plotted thing, and there's an adventure story, and there's a lot that happens, but I was thinking a lot about how one of the things about a poem is that it can be defined in part by just simply the words that it contains and the words that it doesn't. And so this is almost like an expanding territory of language that definitely is fantastical. Like, language doesn't actually work this way. We know that, but it's more like the way like you might learn language through a nursery rhyme or something like that.
Well, one of the things I think that's so amazing about the book is it really draws you in with the basics of what matters to us in reading narrative, which is great characters, a great story, and a great mystery as to how things got this way or exactly what all these words mean. And as it builds that, you talk about using it. Mystery as a plotting device, like the mystery of what exactly words we think of as everyday actually mean and what they mean in this newly defined world.
Yeah, I mean, I guess mystery plots are just something I'm drawn to as a writer. My first novel, The Manual of Detection, was a mystery, but with a sort of surreal, dreamlike element to it. And this book too, I was feeling influenced by mysteries, but even maybe more so by spy stories. I'd been reading a lot of John le Carré's novels and watching a lot of spy movies and thinking about the kind of character who, like the detective of a mystery novel, the spy has to kind of go into dangerous territory seeking a kind of truth, but is usually and in some way changed or corrupted or ultimately transformed by that journey onto the other side of a border. And so my main character in The Naming Song, the courier, she kind of uncovers a plot that is being set in motion to start a new war between the nameless and the named. And in order to figure out why this is happening and how this is happening, she has to kind of delve into her own past. She has to look for her long lost sister and ends up kind of in some very strange territories to learn the truth.
You mentioned her sister, her father, and I love the kind of the family story that is at the core of this. It's very important, but I think what I love about it is that you never play any of your, you don't wear your, as they once put it in Mad Magazine, you don't wear your sausage on your sleeve.
Right.
It's all kind of like everything that happens in the book is based on the world of the book. And that keeps us going, trying to both read, follow the characters and adventures, but also try to build our own picture of the world that you have created. And the family story here is, I think, really a compelling part of it. And I love the pacing of that because it unflowers as the pretty late in the novel.
Right. Yeah. I'm drawn as a writer to telling big stories, to telling adventures with like chase scenes and big conflicts, but ultimately also like the really human side is so important. And I try to get into those intimate spaces with the characters and their pasts. The main character, she kind of grows up in a bit of isolation with her family and is confused about the world. And so there's a way in which we're learning about the world as she learns about it from her father, but he is also not really telling her everything she needs to know. And so it is indeed something she needs to sort out before she can move forward in her own life on multiple levels. I get to draw in really fun ways, like things from my own sort of very quiet childhood in upstate New York. And there are little places and familiar locations that I've folded in throughout, because I did like to think of this world as our world, which has undergone these vast changes and is in the process of being rediscovered and remapped.
Well, one of the things I thought that you have a lot of fun with are trains.
Yes, I love trains. and I'm not sure I can even really justify it in any particular way, except that I love to just write trains into things. There are a lot of the action of this book takes place on two trains in particular. The first part of the book is set on a train called the number 12, which is the home of the Names Committee. They kind of ride around the named territories delivering language, and they're always on the move. They're kind of an exiled group in some ways, and they're also always a little bit under threat from the nameless. And so I got that train, and then I got to indulge in another train with this traveling show that called the Black Square Show, which the courier ends up a part of eventually. I like riding on trains. I like writing on trains when I can. There's something I find very comforting about the feeling of being on the move, but also in a very stationary sort of home, almost home-like space. And trains are one of the few ways you can really get that feeling, I think.
That's kind of a metaphor in a sense of for the novel, where we're with these characters who are doing everyday things to them and sort of everyday things to us, but also we're on the move through this territory that we have no clue as to. We do know is that all language has been removed and it's being slowly reintroduced. The one of the conflicts that drives this novel is between the named and the nameless. And at first we see, you know, the foe as sort of faceless, but I love the way that you slowly ratchet up that characterization of the foe from completely dehumanized to, you know, a new form of human in a sense.
I was thinking a lot about boundaries and borders while writing this, like the borders between sleep and dream and waking and dream is important, and also this border between what is named and what is nameless. And because it is a word, because it is a book made of words, I could not really inhabit the space of the nameless characters. I felt like I could only visit it or try to translate it on the page. And one thing I did was to leave the chapters untitled and try to leave spaces in between sections to give this feeling of the sort of quiet in between the noise.
Did you do the illustrations?
You know, the illustrations came late in the publication process, and I was really pleased when my editor suggested it, because each chapter, instead of having a title, does have a small illustration. And I think that's kind of perfect because it gives you a visual sense of things without needing to rely on words, of course. So, the nameless are this kind of this almost unknowable center in the book, who everything, of course, does eventually turn on, as you know.
One of the things that I loved about this book were what you call the ghosts. This is such a fascinating concept. And so tell us a little bit about the ghosts, because there's a ghost that is the courier's friends. And the way that you kind of build the group of the courier's friends is just wonderful, because it's so sweet and filled with emotion that by the end of the book, there are scenes that will bring most readers to tears, because they're kind of filled with both a joy and a wistful sadness at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, so the ghosts in the novel are one of the big ways in which the world of this book differs from our world, in that when people stop being alive, as they'll say in this book, they become ghosts. But the ghosts are very physical presences. They're mute. They no longer participate in language, but they're present, and they are like walking people who are a very complicated thing for the living to manage. And there are those in the world who want to kind of put the ghosts to work, basically. The ghosts are used as fuel even for some of the machines of the named. And so this gets into some of the sort of darker sides of the society as it exists at the beginning of the book. And the patchwork ghost is indeed the sort of closest friend, oldest friend that the courier has. He's a ghost who came into her father's possession when she was young, and because he studied ghosts as a sort of scientist. And the patchwork ghost is really her steadfast companion. An interesting challenge in putting together this little group of friends, as you mentioned. You know, there's the patchwork ghost, there's a monster, there's also a nameless animal, and I felt like I was kind of forming really a sort of like Dorothy and company troupe, like in you know, in The Wizard of Oz.
Explicitly so.
Yeah. It wasn't on purpose at first, but eventually I saw it. I thought, oh no, I see. I know who these people are. This works really well. So I had to push that once I saw it. But yeah, you know, she's searching for her family and trying to come to terms with the family she grew up with. But in that process, kind of builds this very strange family of folks whose relationship to life and language are all very different from hers, but who she gets to kind of know on a very deep level. And yeah, I hope the readers will find them good travel companions, because I spent a long time writing this book, and I have come to think of them as people who are oddly dear to me.
You know, that's the way they feel to me too. I mean, by the end of the book, you just love all these characters and regard them as your friends. Now, one thing that's interesting, just this to me personally, for the past, I think, God, it's 5 years, I've been working on a show called The Dream Journal. It's a radio show. It plays every week. And one day, it used to play before my interview show. And one day I was driving in and listening to it and thinking, you know what she really needs is some ambient synthesizer music. And this is something I've been doing for longer than I've been reviewing books. So I said, came in and said to her, would you like to have me play some little synthesizer squiggles when people are talking about dreams? She said, okay, fine. So I did that, and I played a couple things. Then after a couple shows, she says, why don't you just play for the whole hour?
And I thought, wow.
Oh my. So here I am 5 years later with 250 hours of music.
And, wow.
But also, I'm well acquainted with dreams and the study of dreams. And you have a really deep interest and import of dreams in your book. Do you yourself keep a dream journal?
I do from time to time. It's not something I do steadily, but I especially find when I am struggling to find time to write fiction for whatever reason, I can always manage a dream journal, and it keeps me feeling connected to, you know, that sort of imaginative side of my brain. And dreams, I mean, dreams for me are just a really useful way for thinking about fiction writing. There's something about a dream when it catches you off guard or surprises you, but knowing that it has somehow yet come from your own mind, that's the feeling I so often strive for in writing, where that I'm hoping to capture this, you know, even for my own self, while writing on the page, I hope to kind of catch myself off guard and do something I didn't expect to see coming, because that's when the story really comes alive for me. So I will plot obsessively, but ultimately it's when this sort of dream feeling takes over and the story starts to write itself that I feel most deeply connected to the work.
Well, the characters themselves, dreams play in a huge part in this book.
Yes.
So talk about, I absolutely love your monsters. I mean, monsters, a novel with monsters and ghosts really got my attention from page one. And we often think of monsters as, you know, Lovecraftian, like the alien or, you know, man in suit, whatever. But right. your monsters are born of dreams, and what I love most about them is they have characters, but they're very, very, you know, they're dreamlike. So talk about creating the monsters in this book as, in a sense, an after effect of the destruction of language, because dreams themselves often they require language to describe them, but they do not submit well to that language.
Yes, that's exactly right. So what I did in this book was to think about various borders, and I decided early on that the people in this world delivered the word for dream before they delivered the word for sleep. And so sleep is kind of a weaker barrier than it is for us. So dreams escape, and everyone has to be kind of very careful about their dreaming so that monsters don't get made in the process. And the main character, the courier, she is in particular, because she is nameless, has to be very cautious about keeping that border firm. And I won't be giving away too much to say she messes up, right? And some monsters do get made. And yeah, I was very much hoping for these monsters to feel like dream logic, the creatures of dream logic that get to go abroad in the daylight. They are highly idiosyncratic. They are total weirdos. I love them. They are can be fearsome as well and dangerous, but I still love them. And that's, to me, like getting to write monsters into this book was one of the real pleasures. I mean, monsters tell us so much about who we are, right? They're like these things which encapsulate our fears and our hopes and our sense of otherness or being othered or just what it might mean to age or to transform or to change or to fear change. And so monsters are just such a useful tool in that sense. And making a monster feel really different from the human, yet giving you the opportunity to connect with them, I think can just really do so much for a story. And so that's a big part of what I was trying to do here.
Well, they're really fun, one of the things that kind of shocked me about my reaction to the book was I loved how sweet some of the monsters were. It's usually yes. I like my monsters to be dripping ichorn and fairly dangerous, in the traditional Lovecraftian mode. The monsters in this book, there were some who were just sweet and wonderful, and you just think, oh my God, this is the best monster I've read in ages.
Oh, that's great to hear. Yeah. I think there's some Miyazaki influence here. Like the Studio Ghibli films were a big influence on this book. He just does such a wonderful job of creating monsters which feel like these things that you would like to get to know, that you would like to spend time with. And I knew I needed some monsters of that type. I don't want to give too much away about where the book eventually goes, but I think what was very interesting to try to do was to give monsters that sense of danger, that dangerousness, while also making them really compelling, and loosing that kind of monster on the world and giving that sort of push and pull feeling with them. Like, is this thing going to be our destruction, or is this thing going to be our best friend? Could go either way.
That's the way with all human inventions.
yes.
Now, in the group that the courier creates around herself, the other member that everybody is going to love and talk about is the stowaway.
Yes,
the stowaway. Who never acquires any further name that never needs a further name. And that you must have been having a lot of fun writing those parts.
I really was, yes. Yeah. So early in the book, the courier delivers the word stowaway so that people who stow away on trains, they have something to be called by. But she also thinks of this particular animal who becomes her companion as a stowaway, because there is no word for this type of animal. It is a small furry creature with whiskers and who makes kind of a rumbling sound if you pet it. So yeah, people I think will pretty quickly recognize what sort of animal this is. But what's great is like when you think of all kinds of domestic animals and pets we may have, it's that type who most easily sort of moves in liminal spaces and likes to disappear into shadows and come back again. And so I leave the type of animal unnamed throughout the book, but this stowaway creature that she becomes very close to, she also ends up kind of having a mental link with him. It's I was playing with the idea of sort of with a lack of borders in certain ways, like minds could mingle to some degree. And so we get to spend some time in this fellow's mind as well.
Now you're talking about spending time in the stowaway's mind, and that's where I think the wonderful things you do so subtle, and you never lean on it too hard. One of the things, science fiction concepts that occurred to me thinking about this book, although it's really nowhere there, and it doesn't get in the frame of the action anyway, is I thought of this book as, in a sense, the idea of the singularity, which is, this idea that computers will get so fast and intelligent that they'll be like godlike beings and change the worlds in ways we do not are not able to understand. This world has been changed in a way we are not able to understand. And one of the ways is that the way we communicate has been broken down, language has disappeared, yet we have begun to acquire on the borders, as you definitely a concern of this book, a different way to communicate that doesn't require words. And this would make words less important. And this idea, I think I really like the way you handle this. You never lean too hard into this. So talk about writing a book where there are big, big ideas in there that you could just really lean into, and I think would have like destroyed the very fragile and wonderful feel of this book.
Yeah, I knew that I needed to write the book from deep in the perspective of the characters who live in this world. So the narrator never uses a word which has not yet been delivered, for example. It's part of why it took me so long to write the book is because it has a kind of a limited diction and a limited use of metaphor. So that was important to me. There are a lot of strange things about the way this world works, but to the characters, it's all they know. They've kind of rebuilt their reality as best they can using the tools they have, and it's a process that is still underway. And so we're getting to see really kind of a world in flux, a world that is operating according to a different set of rules, and those rules are still being written as well. And so that gave me a lot of freedom in some ways. Like although it's very restrictive, I guess, to have these boundaries set around what I can write and put on the page, because I'm only allowed so many types of words. It also was really kind of liberating because within that space I could play and make room for other things like the kinds of communication you're talking about.
One of the things that I really loved about this book is that it gets you into a pace, and it's kind of like a low-key pace in a sense. On one hand, there's lots of really definite menaces. There are people within the world who are immediate menaces to the courier, and she has to deliver a word, and we, as readers, quickly suss what that word is, and it's very important, but it never comes out till near the end of the book. Yet, so after a while, we get very, very comfortable at this pace and enjoying like the wild weirdness you've created. And my God, at the end, you just ramp that up so amazingly well. It's like you said, okay, I'm going to have a hell of a good time here.
Yes.
Talk about it. Just, I think, you know, the writerly joy you must have experienced when you finally let yourself go.
Thanks. Yeah, it's true. I think that part one of the book takes place over the course of about a year. And then parts two and three are like a very, very busy week or so, or maybe even just 3 or 4 days. Like a lot happens very quickly. You know, that was done pretty purposefully. I felt like I needed to take this gentle approach into this world to establish the rules and establish the feeling of the language and the storytelling. I mean, I know of course that the going wisdom in so much science fiction and fantasy writing is that you kind of start with the action and have you know, and just trust that your reader will keep up. And indeed, like things do start happening pretty early. The threats start piling up. But I wanted to create a sort of really welcoming space to really let the reader's mind inhabit this world for a while. But then, yeah, at a certain point, the main character is on the run because she is basically suspected of murder and worse. And so from that point on, it's really kind of a... I guess a bit of a potboiler, maybe. There's a lot happening. There's a lot of dangers, a lot of threats, and a lot of places to get to, a lot of trains to take, and it was very fun to embrace that part of it, while also maintaining my sort of strange rules for writing the book, like how to write these action set pieces when you only have access to so many words, for example. I think it works pretty well, actually, because it has the sort of clipped quality that kind of tumbles right along.
Well, that's one of the things that is wonderful. This is a very book. It's a book that provides the pleasures, I think, that, you know, books provide best. The reader really participates and becomes part of this world, and it, you know, needs must create these kind of incredible visual things that you allude to and describe so well. It does not seem like, you know, it's a lot of books these days, and there are certainly wonderful books. You know, you can kind of see it unfold as a movie. And this book, I think, you see it and experience it. But I mean, the things it shows you and the things that happen are just like nothing you've ever thought of before.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's which is a tricky thing to do and a little scary to put out there, because I'm hoping that readers will trust enough in those opening pages to see where it goes, because I know it's kind of a big ask. I'm suggesting this possibility that that a world could be remade out of silence and rebuilt in ways that we don't necessarily recognize. And so a lot of it is a matter of putting down these footholds and saying, like, you know, keeping the details really familiar and really engaging, so that you could feel like you can find your place in that space. That's really important, I think.
Well, also too, that you're in terms of world building, from square one, you're building an entire world that's unfamiliar to us and will remain so. Yet you want your reader to inhabit it. And as a world, it's really fun to experience that.
Yeah, I mean, when I think of some of my favorite books, they all ask me to work my brain in a different sort of way than I'm used to. Whether that is, you know, Calvino's Invisible Cities or Angela Carter's Fairy Tales. They ask me to come into a different space which the writer has created and entertain a different kind of logic for how language and story interact. And that's, you know, ultimately all I know to do when I write is to create that sort of strangeness and then invite others over, and to try to make that as fun a process as possible, because I want that feeling of discovery that I get from my favorite books.
Well, that, I think, you know, the fun and the joy of reading are a big part of this book. This book is really fun to read. It's fun to discover. You really love the characters, and you're thoroughly invested in them. And one of the things that interests me, too, is that you're creating long character arcs for a pretty big cast in a completely unfamiliar world where the rules, the basic rules of what's real and isn't real, have been thoroughly altered by you. So talk about creating characters that will compel the people in this world who live in a world that is absolutely not this world.
Right. There are a lot of characters, and I think part of that is almost a necessity. I needed to have characters representing all these different ways of being in this place. So there are, in addition to the names committee, there are various other committees. There's the dreams committee, there's the ghosts committee, there's the maps committee. And so I felt like I needed to show glimpses of each of those parts of the world. There is also this traveling show, as I mentioned, the Black Square show, which is kind of responsible for preserving the stories of the culture. And some of those stories, necessarily because they come from this this time of the silence, are wordless. They're like pantomime performances. So I have these characters who are basically like actors and stagehands and directors. I've seen some people referring to this book as a theater kid's dream, which I love, because, you know, getting into that sense of the theatrical space is just another way to play with story, of course. So all of these, in order to tell the story I needed to tell, I needed these characters to all come together in this big undertaking and this big conflict that is brewing, and to show a world kind of, you know, in transformation for each of them, and to have their own arcs. You know, I believe in the usefulness of like some characters who are kind of flat and don't change, because you need them in every story. But I did feel a lot of space here for characters to be confronted with the unexpected and to have their assumptions about the world challenged, so that we can learn that along with them.
One of the things I think that works so well is that it kind of treads the line between being, in a sense, as we read it, we think, is this a fantasy novel where, you know, magic is real and that, et cetera, or is this a science fiction novel where there's, you know, some kind of technology? And I think that you do a great job of treading the line of essentially suggesting that we experience the world, no matter how technological it is, we experience it as a form of magic every day. We wake up from our dreams and create the world as we go around and look at it. And this novel does that for us in a world that is quite a bit like ours, but changed in ways that are dictated by you, the writer. And I think the ways that you have, the fences you built, the borders you built within this world, between that stand between it and us, and within it, create, it's a wonderful kind of writing tension that this is, in a sense, I guess, to drop down into the language of the internet, this is a very meta novel.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I'm trying to be in conversation in various ways with the writers who have influenced me. You know, I think walking that line between science fiction and fantasy is something Ursula Le Guin did a lot, and certainly, of course, thinking about the relationship between language and magic. So, those playing with genres is something I really enjoy doing, and I see them primarily as a way to contribute to a larger conversation. And with this book, I had the fun challenge of kind of breaking it all down and almost rebuilding genre. Without giving away too much, by the end of the book, I think you're in some ways, and maybe a more identifiable genre space. Even though
Oh,
it's
yes.
but it's, there's a world that gets made.
That's why, I never didn't think about that till you just said it, but that's true. By the end of the book, you really do, the world has been thoroughly created in a way the reader can completely understand it, even though it's super original. I mean, as I say, there is no other book that I can think of that even comes close to this. And as we talk about influences, one of the influences that are things that this made me think about was Little Nemo's Dreams in Slumberland.
Yes. Oh, God, I love those. Yes.
And this really had the feel of those with, the kind of, things that are biological but have parts that are not biological.
Yes. Yeah, God, I love the Little Nemo comics. This also, I had some fun conversations over the course of writing this book with John Crowley, another one of my favorite writers. And he and I talked a bit about the relationship between dreams and fiction, and this is territory he has explored, of course, in various ways over the years in his work. And comics more generally also just, as a visual medium, I think can get at that dreamlike feeling that I'm so often trying to grasp at. I'm glad that's all coming through.
Is there a graphic novel adaptation of this in the works?
No, not that I know of. That would be so fun. Yeah, I would love to see that if that were to happen. Yeah.
Or a film, but I think you would need somebody like, in a sense, one of the joys of this book is there are scenes in it that, as you're reading them, you think this would be great on film. You could never film this.
Right. Yeah, I which in some ways are like my favorite films. Every once in a while someone will get it right where they adapt something that seemed unadaptable. If they yeah this it would take a brave director with a very, very clear vision, I think, to make this work, just because of how nameless things work. I mean, one of the conceits of the book is that things without names are difficult to perceive, difficult to grasp. And so you have this sense of the uncanny that is lurking just outside your field of vision, when nameless things are about. And it's part of the job of the courier and others like her to find those things and deliver language to them. And so I can kind of picture how that would look in film, but it would require some cinematic magic, I guess.
Well, and you just used a word I think that I haven't thought of, but it really fits this book well, is uncanny, unheimlich, as
Yes,
Freud would
yes.
have it.
Yes.
And that's because that's a word that we usually think of as being slightly scary, but I think you dial it completely to the other side. So it's slightly wondrous, and you open up uncanny to be, stuff that's slightly disturbing, and some of the scenes are slightly disturbing. Yet
Right.
also there's all the whole thing is just very wonderful.
Right. I like this idea of like maybe being able to take comfort in the uncanny, which there must be some truth to that since we always seek it out.
Do you think you will set more writing in this world?
I think I will. I'm working on a novella for my editor now, which is close to finished. And It doesn't take place in the same setting exactly. It's actually probably hundreds of years in the future from it. So careful readers will see the connections. But I am starting to see kind of a larger web of stories that I could write that both come before and after this book. And so yeah, I think I'm not quite done with that setting yet, even though a lot of the big words get spoken by the end of the novel.
One of the things that this book makes me think is that the story is a this is a story about story itself, in which narrative is a hinge in the plot, in the same way that guns might be, and in fact, in exactly the same way guns might be hinge in a plot of a mystery novel or a spy thriller, as it were. So talk about using narrative as a part of your narrative.
Oh boy. Yeah. Now I've got to talk about talking about talking about the thing. And I don't, it gets into dangerous territory. But it's true that, yeah, I guess I do think a lot about storytelling and the nature of stories. I want to do that stuff without it feeling too quaint, which I think is a danger. This is not a book that tells you, stories will save us. But I think it
No,
come out of the feeling that like stories are a big part of what make us human, and that understanding them and understanding how they work is part of how we can survive, our human selves. And so yeah, that is all in there. There are some big stories in the past and in this future's past which they are still kind of discovering the truth of, and that has a big impact on where things go. I guess it's maybe a bit of a compulsion of mine, because this was the case with the Manual of Detection as well, where I really want the genre material to be upfront with the reader so that we can almost move past it and think about what these structures are telling us about how stories work. And it's so the, it takes on, I hope, a sort of game-like quality where it feels like we're in on it together. And so this is a story about stories. It's a story about fantasy to some degree, and certainly a story about words. And that means we can kind of like hopefully go into some new spaces once we accept that as our shared material.
The new novel by Jedediah Barry is The Naming Song. Thank you for joining me, Jed.
Thank you so much. This has been a real pleasure.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.